You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living.
Professorship as being the bearer of
you are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living.
My goal is to represent the discipline. The secondary goal was to expose people to that. But the primary goal is to represent the discipline as it has evolved and hand that down. That's the primary goal. When you take a multiple guess culture approach to it, what you're also doing, in addition to throwing out discussion, critique, and so on, you're also throwing out tradition, because the answers provided you, there's nothing leading up to the answer. And it's that process of reproducing an argument to a position that represents that historical tradition. So in other words, the best way to learn something is to learn its history, you know, be it physics, biology, mathematics, whatever. The best way to learn that discipline is to learn how it came about to where it is now. And like you say, if you take that approach, then by the same token, you realize that where you are now with respect to philosophy or whatever it happens to be that you're studying is not necessarily the final place. You know, it's going to continue as long as there are humans thinking about it. So I do agree with your author there that we've got to be, and this is why I don't view myself as a scholar for one very good reason, and that reason is I realize that by the time I got to graduate school and postgraduate school, the rot had already set in. So in other words, the people that I admire in academics, you know, whatever the field may be that I'm looking at the time, I realize were so much more the product of a traditional model of education than I am, that I can't really begin to put myself, you know, I could never pull off what Leonard Bernstein pulled off in those Harvard lectures. But the reason he was able to pull it off was that he had been exposed to that. And he even mentions the people in the first lecture that exposed him to this way of thinking in a very multidisciplinary connect the dots fashion, and to be able just to deliver it with effortless ease, which he does. So, you know, you and I are in the position that if we're going to get back to something that is culturally harmonious and not neo-Bolshevism, you know, dressed up by practitioners of it that are vapid even by Lenin's intellectual achievements, you know, we have to get back to this idea that we have to have a certain humility before the great academics of yesteryear, because they are by far and away far superior to anything coming out of the modern academy, bar none. I think this attitude that there has to be a certain humility before any of the subject matter is absolutely essential. Absolutely essential.
You mentioned Leonard Bernstein and the lectures in 1973, and I'll definitely find those. I bet I can find them on YouTube. And I'll,
they are.
Yeah, and I'll link those in the show notes. It's one of the things that I always got so much from, and I still do, as far as learning, is the power of the lecture.
Yes.
You know, when somebody is learning on a topic and they are excited about it and they find joy telling you about it, and you can just sit back and listen. And the thing is, it's almost like you're time traveling, because that person might be, say, 50 years old, and they've been studying something all their lives. And so you think about it, you're getting maybe like hundreds of years of study, of knowledge, in an hour, and all you have to do is watch. I think that something I found in my education so far, I would say, let's say my public school education, mm-hmm. was that the power of the lecture was overlooked.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I have to agree with you. Again, it's like I say, we have, in this country, we've all but lost the tradition of the grand academic lecture. What professors do anymore is they come in and they give you a book report on what, you know, the textbook is. And even there, our American system doesn't even know what a textbook is. A textbook is a book of primary texts. That's what it is. But what we call textbooks now are textbooks of secondary sources and someone telling you what someone thought. In other words, you go to a philosophy class, you read a philosophy textbook, and they're telling you what Plato's system was rather than actually reading Plato. Okay. This is the other problem. And, you know, I taught 1 year a medieval philosophy class when I was a professor, and I used a textbook, in other words, a book of primary texts, and had the students read it. And, you know, it was a totally new experience for them from the standpoint was that this was the first time that they'd ever been exposed to the actual writings of an Aristotle or a Plato or a Thomas Aquinas or, you know, who have you, including some Muslim philosophers from the Middle Ages. And it was new to them, and it was difficult. But once they got into it and learned to trust their own mind as to what they were reading, rather than being spoon-fed the pre-selected answer, once they figured out, hey, yeah, I've got a mind, I can use it, it's okay to trust it, it's a liberating experience. And you can see, and the nicest thing about that class was I could stand up there and be talking about stuff, and I could see the lights going off in the faces of different students. And that's when they would get excited about it. When that light went off, I was right. I can trust my mind to make my own observations and handle this information and interpret it. That's what we lack. And part of that is that absence of the grand academic lecture. You know, what does Shakespeare have to do with Noam Chomsky? What do they have to do with Mozart or Bach? Well, you know, watch Bernstein and how he connects all of this, you know, and that's the lecture in the grand academic style. So, yeah, we've lost that, too. And it's because of this nutty American idea that we have got to standardize everything. We are, in spite of all of our opposition to the Soviet Union, we are one of the most collectivist countries on the face of the planet. You look at Soviet education, and much to your surprise, you will see their students being looked at as individuals, and individuals being selected out for, you know, skipping several grades in whatever subject they were good at, be it painting or mathematics or what have you. So it was almost the diametrically opposite sort of educational philosophy than you would think. So we've got to get rid of education as mass marketing and heavy industry and assembly lines, and get back to the idea that you're dealing with individuals with individual minds. And the only way to do that, you can't do it on a standardized test form. The only way to do it is analog. The only way to do it is have a teacher in a classroom with individuals, and they're interacting and talking with each other. That's the only way to do it.
Well, you mentioned in Russia how they will find the students who have a particular natural dexterity for something, and then right. say, well, here's more courses in that direction. Here's some people who are – here's some professors. Here's whatever, you know, school that they're in. I think that's amazing because, like, for an example – when I was in the military when I was a youngster, you know, I was a really good shot. And mm-hmm. so they said, well, you should be a marksman. Here, go do this.
Right.
And I went, great. And it interested me. I like shooting. And right. I still remember when I was working at, you know, some long-range shooting, I remember a captain came up to me and he said, I was asking him some questions. He was working with me and he said, you know, we have all these numbers. We have all this, you know, elevation, this, that, wind. But in the end, you know, with your mind, you got to reach out and feel it. You got to put your finger right. on that target.
Right.
And when you make that connection, you'll hit it.
And so, now.
Yes.
now what would they do? They'd tell you, don't shoot so well. You'll make somebody else that can't shoot so well feel bad.
You know? Come on, this is a union job. You're going
to... That's a union job.
You're going to set a higher standard.
We don't want that.
No. Yeah. Well, I do think that... Now, I mean, this is a huge topic. I just have a belief that... People often ask, you know, what is the meaning of life? And Joseph Campbell said, well, when you experience life, you'll know the meaning. And I've oftentimes thought that really pursuing our interests, just what interests you, right. and then pursuing it, really
right.
do that and you'll have enough meaning to your life. Right. And it seems that the multiple choice education is really removing people's ability to find interest and experience in life at a very young age.
Yes, it does. I totally agree with you. You know, one of the things I say over on my vidcast to people is you've got to own the culture. And that doesn't mean you've got to go out and be a PhD in all aspects of culture. What it means is you've got to find that one area that you're passionate about, be it gardening, painting, music, you know, writing books, fixing cars, whatever. And pursue that, you know, pursue what gives you joy and happiness and become competent and good at it. And that will inevitably draw people of a similar interest to you. And that will be the leaven that will fix the culture. Listening to these narratives and regurgitating pre-selected answers, you know, that's turning you into a passive instrument. And we've got to be active in whatever it is that gives us joy or meaning. And you're right. At a very early age, I think this multiple choice culture really is designed not only to isolate you from a tradition, it's also designed to make you totally passive because you're regurgitating an answer that you have not derived yourself.
Yeah, and pursuing that interest to and learning about something and then having your own findings is essential. It truly
yes.
is. It truly yes. is. And so that's just making sure that, you know, kids at a very young age don't have that. Well, you did mention that you've composed music, you're a musician, mm-hmm. you know, and I am myself. I guess many people are. And we're always humble about it, I find. I mean, even Jimi Hendrix said I can kind of play guitar, you know? And so I think that's what we're all doing. It's a path. Wherever you're at, and you work on it. And that's it's right. an interest, you know? So you work at it. It's like even Arnold Schwarzenegger said, if you're at the gym and you're exerting some effort, then you're doing what I'm doing, you know?
Right.
So I'm curious... Because you'd mentioned the importance of music in mm-hmm. education, and mm-hmm. I do agree. And to be a musician, to whatever extent one is a musician, whatever their passion might be, whatever their interest is, if you play anything even a little, and maybe right. that changes, you like drumming, then maybe you like playing the bass, then maybe you want a harpsichord, then the next thing you know, you want a harmonica. Everyone should have a collection of instruments that have interested them.
Right.
And it's not about being a master, it's just about the musical interest and rhythm right. and playing. It does something for the soul, does something for the mind.
Yes.
And how do you feel that musical knowledge, the interest in being a musician of any kind, affects our ability to learn and then our perception of the world?
Well, I wrote a book called Microcosm and Medium, which is really about mind control. But the first chapter is about the arts and more specifically music. I believe that there was a great cosmological change in the arts between the Baroque style and what followed it. And the change is in how they approach artistic expression of the human passions versus artistic expression of subjective emotion. It's a huge change. If you listen to the Baroque era composers, they're dealing with the idea that music can appeal to the passions that all humans share, and that music can actually conjure those universal responses. So in other words, a Baroque composer is not composing music to express himself. He's composing music to express an idea. And the idea is something universal, and it's very complex. They're also coming out of a Christian milieu where they are trying to express a multitude of individual voices that are making harmonious sense. So I don't say it's just any music that rewires the brain. It is specifically a contrapuntal harmonious music, J.S. Bach, Buxtehude, Mozart, and so on, that you have multiple lines of music all proceeding independently and yet making perfect harmonious sense that doesn't grate on the ear. It draws you in. It requires that you listen or perform the music with intellectual awareness and activity rather than passivity. If you listen to modern music, what do you hear? Well, you hear a line of melody. It's got some chords underneath it, and then boom, 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 boom. You've got the jungle drum beat. So it's a one-dimensional music rather than a multi-dimensional music that you can listen to vertically, horizontally, and so on. So I think there's something to be said about what type of music it is. But I think all music, as you point out, I think all music, whether you play guitar or violins or whatever, you are required by the nature of the case to probe into a composer's thought process, which is right there in the score, and understand it and be able to rationalize it. And once you start thinking in those terms, then it begins to rewire your own mind so that you can deal with a multitude of things at the same time. You know, think of jazz. You're listening to something where people are improvising on the spot, and yet they're trying to do so in such a way that it comes out making harmonious sense. So you're dealing with a very similar mentality. But that's by the nature of the case. That's going to rewire the mind to think in a multitude of connections. What does this mean? Why is he doing this and not that? And so on. You're required to think about it. So I think music, you know, music used to be part of the absolute core of the so-called hard disciplines in the classical area, the trivium, the quadrivium, geometry, mathematics, music. You know, well, why music? You know, it's a hard discipline to learn, as you know, you've studied it. So it is, you know, it's one of the hardest things to learn and learn well. And when you get into music theory, you know, there's a reason that in many European universities, doctors of music come at the head or close to the head of any academic procession. There's a reason for that. And the reason is that this is an extraordinarily difficult subject matter. You're dealing with mathematics, you're dealing with physics, you're dealing with art, you're dealing with the process of creativity, and, you know, it's all thrown together, all at the same time. So I think it's absolutely essential. And look at what our multiple choice culture has done with music in the curriculum. It's made it an afterthought. It's made it a secondary appendage, which I don't think it should be. I think you should be exposed to some sort of music from the get-go, because it rewires the mind and enables you to think in a multi-track, multi-dimensional way rather than a one-dimensional way.
And it reminds me of someone I know who was from Asia. He was Japanese, and he said that here in this country, we will consider our child to be naturally gifted. And he was saying in his culture, nobody is naturally gifted.
Right.
Your ability to be gifted equals your ability to struggle.
Right.
He was like, forget it. You're not gifted. If you're gifted at all, it's because you're willing to struggle. And he was like, that's how we find our greatness, is that you find something that you love and you're willing to struggle.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like your success will be equal to your masochism.
Well, yeah, you know, it's a very interesting point. You know, I'm kind of a Platonist in this respect, in that, you know, if you look at what Plato says about genius, basically what he's saying is everybody's a genius because everybody's absolutely unique person and has an absolutely unique personal approach to things. So this kind of exposure, particularly to something like music, as you know, every musician can perform the same piece of music, and it's going to be slightly different, and there's going to be certain nuances in the music that an individual will bring out because of their makeup, of their ability to see certain things in the score. So, you know, I'm kind of in that philosophy myself, that you have to identify what your niche is and what you're passionate about and good at, and then struggle to master it. And again, in the modern multiple choice culture, that's just thrown right out the window. You know, again, I'm not interested in how you got your answer. I just want to know that you're able to take your number two lead pencil and fill in the little oval without going over the lines correctly.
And that's really something. I think that's a unique perspective of what you just said. You know, find what you are good at and struggle.
Yeah.
You know, because then it won't necessarily be struggle. That would be more like your bliss, you know. Like,
well, remember what J.S. Bach said?
What did he say?
He said, anybody can do this. Now stop and think. This is J.S. Bach. Composed gobs of music. None of it bad. You know, that's the problem. And his statement was, anybody can do this with hard work. Anybody. So in other words, here we have, you know, to my mind, you know, the greatest musical genius of all time saying, anybody can do this. Just go out and put in the work. That's all, you know. That's all it requires. In other words, yeah, you can write music like him if you sit down, study him, and figure out how and why he's doing things. But that takes work, you know. So we'd much rather in contemporary American culture say that someone's a musical genius for contriving a good melody and propping it up with a few chords with a jungle drum beat going on in the background. Well, I'm sorry, doesn't compare. It just doesn't. But if you can do that, and do it in several lines of music, all moving at the same time, making harmonious sense, then you're going somewhere.
I remember a tabla teacher of mine, an instrument that I have interest in is the tabla, mm-hmm. the Indian two drums. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to take on something that didn't relate to Western music at all. Not the rhythm, none of it, you know. And anything about, you know, tabla and a lot of Indian music that I learned is it's all it's hardly ever written. It's verbally, you know, it's
transmitted.
Like, yeah, it's like teri-teri-taka-taka-da, you know, they actually will recite a piece of music to one another and go, I got it, and then they'll play it. And I went, wow, this is different. So it really opened my mind to a lot of ways I just hadn't ever thought of music. I mean, going from the staff and looking at the notes to just how does that go? And they actually have sounds that they create, and it's amazing. And then actually being able to recite music verbally is a skill that they learn also. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. you say that you can be clear so that you can recite it to people so that they can play it. And a tabla teacher who was quite accomplished said to me, he said, it's all hard. Yeah, he says, tabla's hard. You know, it's all struggle. Mm-hmm. There's not one mm-hmm. bit of it. He's like, if you want something easy, just forget it. The tabla is struggle. If that's not interesting, then don't bother.
Yeah. Yes. I have, my mother was able to play anything she heard on the radio by ear. Hear it, sit down and play it. You know, and I wish I could. I'm not one of those people that can do that. But, It's so essential to education, in my opinion, that this is one reason our culture is so flat and so bereft of any high artistic tradition is we've created a kind of mediocrity, to derive the word from the word mediocre, where any creativity is valued. And my problem is, okay, is it high creativity or is it just more mediocre creativity? And if you don't expose yourself to the high tradition, you're not going to have any high tradition. And this is the other problem. And again, it's this multiple guess question. All answers are equal, and we're not interested in how you got there. So in other words, we're not interested in you, the individual. It's a collectivized education system. And it goes, you know, it goes right to the roots, because the people that set this up, you know, John Dewey, what's the other one, James Bryant Conant, and all these people, well, they're coming out of Wilhelm Wundt in Prussia. You know, how did we, the United States of America, end up with an essentially Prussian approach to education? Well, it's thanks to Wilhelm Wundt, who was the original stimulus response psychologist. I mean, Pavlov was one of his students. So what does that tell you? So education became stimulus response, and that's all it is. And there's a complete lack of the idea that the person represents anything more than a bundle of chemical reactions and stimulus response mechanisms. And of course, that is a tremendous reduction of personhood. So it's no wonder we're in the culture that we're in, because we've literally trained whole generations of people to think of themselves as nothing but response mechanisms, and that's it. And that, you know, that response is much more Marxist, if you stop and think about it. Much more Marxist than anything that we saw coming out of the Soviet educational system, which in its own way was almost the exact opposite. You know, composers like Shostakovich or Prokofiev working and laboring under the guise dictates of socialist realism in the Soviet Union, and yet they're producing this wonderful music. And what are we producing? You know, at the same time, it doesn't hold a candle, I have to tell you. It really doesn't. So I think you're right. This multiple guess culture is a good way of putting it. I think you're looking at the cultural results of an educational system that is founded on entirely the wrong principles. Music is out the window. Oh, but you can throw a football. You
know. Oh, definitely. Well, something I wonder about is when it comes to the multiple choice education, our multiple choice society, multiple guest society, and digital versus analog, is when I hear music, when I hear youngsters playing music right now, when I hear youngsters listening to music, and I guess, well, I'm 50. You know, and so I guess I can say youngsters are people younger than I am. I do think that there are so many, let's say millennial generation, mm-hmm. who have only ever heard digital music.
That's right.
And they've only heard, and so it makes me wonder if that's how the system kind of works to a certain extent, because if you've heard analog music, like we were lucky enough to have grown up with reel-to-reel players, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Records, you know, mm-hmm. I had 75s and 45s and such like that. And mm-hmm. so I go, yes, it was great. So now when I hear strictly, and in many cases, I mean, I love this stuff today. Like if you can find an old, like wind up record player and you can, oh my gosh, I love it. And people are beginning to have an instinct to go back to that. Well, luckily enough, if you were young and you've experienced that, or maybe you're a little mm-hmm. bit older, and a little bit younger, and you've taken interest in it, when you hear today's music, we know when a car goes by, boom, 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 or you whatever.
Oh,
you,
tell me about it.
Yeah, so, you know, you hear that, and it does seem like when I hear a lot of the music of the day, of today, that is digital music, and I would say that the interests that are dumbing us down, I would literally call it propaganda, that music, yes. to dumb us down, It only works because there's a generation that has never heard analog music.
Right. I would definitely agree with that. My problem, you know, and I say this to people over and over again, I don't particularly care if they like Bach or not, but they've got to listen to him because they don't realize what an intellectual feat is really being accomplished. To write and compose, let's say you listen to the Gloria from his little F major Lutheran Mass. It's a 5-minute long piece. In 5 minutes, you're listening to 10 independently moving lines of music, 5 of them being the choir, and you will hear 3 fugues over an orchestral part that's repeated. So you've got a 5-voice fugue over a repeated basso ostinato in the bass, and you've got little figurations going on in the rest of the orchestra that are mimicking the text. So just to sit down and analyze 5 minutes of music will yield enormous intellectual fruits just to be able to compose something like that. But now in the digital age, you're right. We think music is boom, 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 boom. And one line of music propped up by a bunch of chords. And this is... you know, this to me is dull music. It's nice for entertainment. You know, you don't have to sit around and listen to Mozart all day long. You can listen to the Bee Gees or whatever. But it's important to understand that there is a high tradition, that not all art is created equal. Rembrandt is not in the same category as Jackson Pollock. But in America, we've got this idea that there is no hierarchy, there's no tradition, and therefore all art is equal. And it's, again, part of this, I think, this multi-choice view of things that, you know, we're only interested if you go along with the narrative. And I think that this is exactly, that you're exactly correct. What this is it's producing an art that's dumbing us down. And it's not only dumbing us down, but it's doing something else very significant. It's desensitizing us to ugliness. It's desensitizing us to ugliness. We now accept the ugly as equal artistic value to the beautiful or to the good. So we've lost all sense of anything, really, in our culture, specifically American culture, that's transcendent. And this is the other problem. And you remove music from the curriculum, and this is the result. And even then, music, if it is taught in the curriculum anymore, well, how many times can you listen to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture? And even in those so-called music appreciation classes, they're not telling you how the music works, so you can't appreciate it. So on and on we could go. This all goes back, I think, to what's going on in the Quacademy. We have accepted mediocrity and leveling and a collectivist philosophy, essentially. And are we surprised at the results? And the solution, folks, is not to throw more money at it or raise teachers' salaries. That is not the solution. It requires a systematic, deep philosophical analysis of why this system is not producing people that can think or compose or paint or sculpt or write a decent novel, much less a sentence of recognizable English, and on we could go.
It's funny how today when I look back at when I went to public school, mm-hmm. You know, I can remember there's only a few teachers that really inspired me, mm-hmm. and that's, you know, unfortunate, but you remember those 3 and all of those that inspired, and, you know, I'm 50, so, you know, I'm actually 50 today, it's my birthday, so that gives people an idea of, you know, where I'm at. And so when I went to high school and grade school, really there's like 3 teachers that inspired me. And I know it was a different world then, different, you know, curriculum than it is today, but all of them had to break from the norm.
Bingo.
To actually inspire us. They had to do something that wasn't part of the curriculum. They had to teach us something that they did not have to. And that's what inspired us.
Right, exactly. They got out of the box, and my suspicion is that they did this deliberately. They got out of the box that their education courses told them that they had to teach in. And without exception, this has been my experience as well. And I would suspect it's been most people's experience. And that should tell us how broken the system is. Because you've got what I call the subversive teacher that knows the system is broken and they are doing everything they can to fulfill the requirements of the system. But at the same time, their real interest is over here. And that's what they're teaching. And that's why they're effective. There's so many people like that on my website. I can't even begin to. We have a lot of teachers, and they're almost to a man or a woman, they're that kind of teacher. They're thinking and teaching outside of the system and its requirements.
Definitely. It's just like Dan Carlin's book at the Amazon store, where you've got all this, you know, pillars of neo-Bolshevism. Then there's like Dan Carlin's little book. It's like, hey, think broader perspective. See the now that we are in historically. You know, oh my gosh. And so that is being that subversive, you know, sneaking that in there. Think. And I remember that. I mean, I remember those few teachers that I had. You know, there was one English teacher who was very frustrated that we were supposed to, you know, learn about Shakespeare, but it was in a cold way. And so we all read it and we talked about it. Then we read, you know, of course, Romeo and Juliet, then West Side Story. And like, what are the differences in our societies today? And this and that. And I remember it. I remember it. And I go, oh my gosh, if only youngsters could have everything they learned be that enthralling. Mm-hmm. If every teacher they had and every course they had changed their lives as it should, it's very sad that it does not. Definitely.
And who composed the music for West Side Story?
I don't know. Oh, Leonard Bernstein.
Leonard Bernstein.
Oh, my God.
and if you listen to the music of West Side Story, he does interesting things like sneak in a fugue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's fugues. He takes all these classical forms and just plops them right down. And people are listening and say, this is pretty good stuff. Well, there's a reason it's pretty good stuff. He's using traditional forms in that music. It's, you know, and again, it's sad that somebody like him would put so much effort into that musical and people listen to it and not understand what he's doing and why the music is effective.
And that's the thing about learning being hard. When you have interest in something, it is hard to learn about it. Learning is effort. And the more you know about music theory, the more you know about music, then the more of your brain is excited. The hearing music excites you. You experience it in a completely different way. It's like wine, for instance.
Yeah, it is.
If you go to a winery and you learn about the process and the different types of grapes and what they did. So if you just walk in and taste something, okay, I tasted it. There you go. Then have them describe their passion, the whys, the hows, the struggles, the seasons, all of that. And you taste it again. Different experience. Completely.
Yep.
Deeper experience. And so I think the digital world is cheating people out of a deeper experience of life, obviously.
Well, since we're talking about education and culture and the neo-Bolsheviks, what famous American educator was the chairman of the American Committee, the International Committee, investigating Stalin's charges against Leon Trotsky?
I don't know.
John Dewey. John Dewey. It's in the second McCarthy book. John Dewey. So what's this progressivist educator? What's his interest in defending Leon Trotsky? That should set off alarm bells for everybody concerned with American education. That should set off a lot, big alarm bells. Why him and why Leon Trotsky? There's your neo-Bolshevism right there. right there.
And that's definitely something I love about you as a writer is, you know, I'm only on my second book, but I love the depth. And now it inspires me to go back and read that one. So eventually I'll get through them all. But these things are important in understanding our world, you know, as it is this moment. It's just like understanding a fine wine. You might taste it and go, eh, it's all right. Then learn about it. And you learn. Go, oh my God, it's amazing. Whole different story.
We've lost in this country the idea of craft. We've lost the idea of the craftsmanship it takes to build an automobile, or that it takes to engineer an ocean liner or a steam locomotive, or to build a guitar or what have you. You know, we're consumers of things rather than experiencers of things. And there is a difference, because the consumer experience is always going to be shallow. And if you experience something, you know, whatever it may be, whatever your passion is, then part of that experience is always, 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 I can't think of any other way to put this, but part of that experience is knowing the history of it, knowing what led up to this guitar that you're holding in your hands or what have you. And that, as you say, that deepens the experience. And if you have an educational system that's designed to cut you off from tradition, well, at the same time, it's cutting you off from having that kind of experience with whatever it is you encounter. So again, I think you're, I just love that. I think this qualification of it as the multiple guest culture is very profound, quite frankly. I love it. Yeah. I might be using it from time to time with your permission.
Oh, that's totally fine. Yeah. And I think maybe that will be a book in your future, you know,
maybe, or, who knows?
Yeah. Or maybe my future, maybe I'll be the one who writes that one. But yeah, the implications of multiple choice education. And, well, something along those lines I wanted to ask you is the multiple choice or multiple guess education world, is that affecting autodidactic learning? Because I feel that it's sort of erasing or not letting people see the possibility of autodidactic learning, as in being self-taught. And I think anybody who's been around a little while has realized that some of the best in what they do are autodidactics who taught themselves.
Yes, I totally agree with you. It's manifest in this way. What we now think culturally in this country and in most Western countries is that getting an education means getting a degree. And that once you got your degree, subliminally, you think, well, I'm educated. And I used to tell my students, you know, I used to ask them at the beginning of my classes in college, why are you here? And I'd always get these people to say, that would say, to get a degree, to get my degree. And my response was, well, you can go down to the Masonic Lodge and get a degree for far less money, and you'll probably have a lot more fun, you know. So we've got to get this idea that the piece of paper doesn't mean you're educated, number one. And number two, that education doesn't stop. It never stops. It never stops. And I'm in total agreement with you. This multiple guest culture is creating a culture where people are not willing to trust their own mind. And if you're not willing to trust your own mind, then you're never going to become an autodidact. You're never going to want to learn on your own. You're never going to see narratives as something to be critiqued and challenged and analyzed and dissected and so on and so forth. So I think your observation is spot on.
And then how would you address people who lack a little bit of confidence because they're autodidacts? Because, you know, many people, maybe the only way they could have become as good at what they do and their passion was through being an autodidact. But yet it seems that many people still lack a bit of confidence in their own self-learning because it wasn't through the university. It wasn't formal. Mm-hmm. And they'll feel that, well, I don't know it all, and there's holes in my knowledge, where it really seems that, well, it's because our learning never ends.
My response has always been kind of twofold, and I used to tell this to my students all the time. Trust your own mind. Trust your own mind. You don't have to have a piece of paper telling you that you are educated. If anything, what you and I have been saying tonight is a piece of paper from a modern American company is more likely to indicate that you are functionally stupid. And therefore, why is it of concern to you to have a piece of paper or a formal education? It's much more important to be competent in a subject. That's what an education used to be. So why would the piece of paper give you confidence that, you know, why does confidence have to come from something external? You have to be to the point that you know, God created you in his image, and that means you have a rational faculty. And you can use that faculty with confidence because it's God-given. And, you know, on my website, we've got everything. We've got Christians, we've got atheists, we've got agnostics, we've got Buddhists, we've got, you know, it's all over the board. And one reason it's all over the board is that most of those people in my vid chats are trusting their own mind and could care less about, you know, what academic degrees anybody else has. We're just there to discuss things. And I think a large part of it is because those people have learned to trust themselves and to trust their mind. We don't need a panel of experts telling us how to think. You know? And usually, you know, I go back to Don S. Hoffman and his dispute with the Educational Testing Service. They supposedly had all the experts, and yet they're producing questions on physics exams that are nonsense. You know? So, trust your mind. It's that simple.
No, it's very essential. Yeah, trust your mind. So essential. And I guess as we've been on for almost 2 hours, you know, and I don't want to keep you too long. It's so funny when, you know, doing interviews, of course, you always have all these notes and all this stuff. And you always think, oh my gosh, I hope I have enough that we can, you know, that I keep them talking. And then, of course, you end up going over like this little piece of it and you go, oh, you know. But it's awesome because I didn't really think we'd talk about analog versus digital. And we did. And that's actually a great theme of the of our chat tonight. Well, one thing I would ask, because, I mean, it's probably a good time to start wrapping it up. I don't want to keep you all night. We've covered so much ground. This is definitely
good for a few more minutes.
No, yeah. This is definitely, you know, a lot of data, and it was better than I expected. Well, in seeing the world, maybe as, you know, Dan Carlin suggests, as a historian, like realizing that you don't know it all right now, that it will come to be in the future. You will know some now, and then some things you can kind of put. You can put facts in kind of a neutral file and see if they prove to be true in the future. And just your opinion, your knowledge of something will go on forever as you are alive. Mm-hmm. Well, something I would ask about, because it's on everyone's minds these days, and I don't think it'll make it a timely interview. I think it will still be a timeless interview, is the coronavirus. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's thinking about it. And what I have noticed is that there are some that are just fearful of it. There are some that are oblivious to it. Then there are some that are intellectually attacking it with friends from every single conceivable angle. Right. And to me, at least humbly, I would say that's the correct way to do it.
Yes, I would totally agree. The way I look at this story is it's another one of these events and narratives that's being put out there. And almost as soon as it was put out, people began analyzing and dissecting, which I think, like you, is a very good thing, because it means that the elites are no longer able to manipulate any information and get away with it. In other words, we're no longer in the days that we were in 1964 with the Warren Report. You know, here's the official story, take it or leave it. We're in a position now with the internet, with so much information out there and with so much cynicism and mistrust of institutions that have abandoned, for all intents and purposes, any attempt to maintain Western civilization, culture, tradition, and so on, that this is the inevitable result. So I'm glad that there are people dissecting this. I may not agree with all their dissections, but I certainly am glad that it's going on, because increasingly it looks to me like we're being fed another narrative. There's all sorts of murky stuff in the background of this one. And this is the problem now that the elite has, is people have woken up. And every narrative only wakes up more people. And that's the other problem they're facing. They either have to come up with a new playbook. And, you know, I go back to something I said many years ago when I was interviewing with George Ann Hughes. The problem that the elites have is that they've surrounded themselves with their own yes men. They've surrounded themselves with, you know, standardized test takers that have regurgitated their own narrative. And therefore, they are incapable, it looks to me, of thinking outside their own box. These are people that have begun to believe their own propaganda. And as a result of that, they're unable to respond to the changing situation because they have no critical faculty. So the coronavirus to me is kind of, it kind of epitomizes this cultural predicament that we're all in, the elite especially. That's my thought.
Definitely, because it seems to me like more and more to be the elite, as we call them. I mean, people will define that in many, many different ways. You know, like one of my ways of summarizing it is I borrow a term from a modern day philosopher, Neil Cramer. I just call it empire, you know?
Yeah, it is.
So empire, elite, whatever we want to call it. It's gotta be a real pain in the ass right now to be them, because I mean, as soon as they do something, there's just this swarm of people who are like, I mean, from honestly, they can't create a bulletproof. They cannot create a perfect narrative or event anymore. And you actually can see, and I personally find it as inspiring, they're kind of dumb.
They are. It's like I say, they can't think outside the box that they themselves have created. And that's their problem. They are fundamentally dumb. They are fundamentally stupid. They've bought into all the wrong philosophies for all the wrong reasons, and they're trying to make everybody else dance to their tune. Look at Brexit versus, you know, the United Kingdom versus the bureaucrats in Brussels. They cannot respond in any other way other than the same old way. More social programs, bigger government, and so on and so forth. And it's just not washing anymore, because what people are waking up to is that what these people have been doing to them is denying them of their cultural identity and traditions. And this is a process, you know, I go back to what I said in Rotten to the Common Core. This is a process that really began with the progressivist movement, at least in this country and many Western European countries, that really began towards the tail end of the 19th century. Well, okay, how util is a late 19th century materialist progressivist Victorian philosophy going to be in the 21st century? It's just it's not going to be very helpful. You know, physics has gone beyond that. Mathematics has gone beyond that. Biology's gone beyond that. You know, everything has kind of moved away from the 19th century progressivist Victorian model. And yet here we have an educational elite and a financial elite and a corporate elite still pushing more or less the same thing. And what we see as a result is the complete decay of the culture. So fundamentally, this to me is not about politics. This is about culture. That's really what's going on.
And I think we see that in Virginia
Oh, yeah.
And this is where I see where whenever I think we all go between feeling neutral, hopeful, and then sometimes hopeless. I go, you know, back and forth. And one of the things that gives me hope is I look at Virginia and people that are very, how would I put it? I don't know, not very eclectic, maybe necessarily have not been particularly intellectual. I will call them the implications of the multiple guest culture. There they are. Well, in Virginia, you have this attack on really the Bill of Rights, Americans' culture in a state which is fairly sovereignty-minded. And I hear people saying for the first time in their lives going, you know what? The government has nothing at all to do with us. And they will do whatever they can get away with to the extent that they can. And then they'll say something like, and I think that they're serving, it's as if they're serving some kind of an artificial intelligence.
Well, listen, that would be a topic of a whole other discussion. But I actually think that much of the problems we face are because we have turned over so much of the functioning of society to the digital demon. For example, and I've mentioned this with Catherine Austin Fitz many, many times, most of our commodities trading, equities trading, sovereign securities trading, corporate bonds, you name it, most of this is now being done by computer algorithms. So in other words, market activity no longer reflects genuine human activity. And as a result, you know, oh, the stock market's up. And my response is, big deal. What do machines know about the realities of what humans are facing on a day-to-day basis in the market? This I think, is absolutely true. And the other thing about Virginia as a cultural phenomenon is I'm finding it very, very interesting now. From California to Virginia, you're having more and more people starting to talk openly about the idea of secession, be it, you know, West Virginia inviting all these Virginia counties to join West Virginia, you know, to people in California that, you know, want to take the state out of the hands of Sacramento, San Fran Freak Show, and LA. And again, I don't blame them. But I think this is only going to increase. And what it tells me is the centralization paradigm is breaking down. But more importantly, the underlying cultural paradigm that's behind all of that is breaking down. And more, I mean, if you think the American federal government is out of touch with the vast majority of people, imagine a global government. Imagine centralization to that extreme.
Wow.
And you think anything that you or I are going to say or do or vote is going to make the slightest bit of difference to that kind of monstrosity? Well, the answer is no. And people sense this and they're saying, enough, we're going in the wrong direction. So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen if this country ends up in a tyranny, a civil war. I don't know. But I do know all empires fail. All empires fail. And they fail for the same fundamental reasons they always fail. Plutocracy, mercantilist policies, economic policies, military overreach, over-centralization, and so on and so forth. This is the way they always fail.
You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living.